This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. Taking care of business and working overtime. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and boys and girls of all ages. This is Don Soa with Donna Soa Allard in studio for Get Back to Basics Tuesday right here on the Money Talk program. We're delighted that you're joining us here on AM 790 during what is probably, for many of you, your drive time home. If you are driving home, of course, drive safely. If you are in a position where you do have a question for us, but you'd like to transmit that question to me, give Brett a call. He's our producer, and he will plug it into my screen. We don't want you to be driving and talking at the same time.
Sorry, you said transmit questions to you all. I got like some sort of Princess Leia coming up on a portal, getting messages to you in a hologram. Like,
well, it's probably stored inside a droid. You know, what can you do?
You're the only one who can help.
I'm the only one that can help.
Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Exactly.
Take your tour, my willer. Powerful Jedi. Well, anyway, we welcome
like
you.
Like a finance Jedi.
The finance Jedi, though, you know, and Jedi having been doing this at some point in time. I forget at what point the producers of the show designated me as a financial Jedi master. But, you know, at some point you go that route.
I think maybe Arlene. Did Arlene Violet denote you as a Jedi finance master?
Probably at some point she probably did, and now I have my young Padawan.
It's a long time ago.
My young Padawan, Donna Soa Allard, training to be a future financial Jedi and learning along the way. The whole point of everything that we do here on the Money Talk program is about education to some degree. I know that when you have the commercials, they talk about, entertainment, and, I don't know ultimately how entertaining the world of money and finances, but I hope it's important. I mean, when it really comes right down to it, so many of the decisions that we have to make in life are based upon not so much whether you know everything. Maybe there's the assumption that you don't, but the most important thing is that you are able to formulate the kinds of questions that will get you the information that you desperately need to make good decisions.
And that's right, because no one has to know all of the answers. You just need to know where to go to get the answers or how to find them.
Well,
right?
We even warn people here on the Money Talk program. This has been a call-in talk show for, 26 years now. They're more and more now lately, especially since we're in the early part of the drive time here at 5 o'clock, we don't get as many questions here on the air. And I even had a couple of state troopers that I know say, Donald, please don't ask people to call you up on the radio. I mean, because if they're doing that, they're calling you up on a cell phone while they're driving. He's actually see them on the phone. Half the time I look over and say, oh, look at that guy. I'll bet he's trying to call into Don Soa's Money Talk program. And I said, well, okay, I appreciate that. But at the same time, I had an occasion here on the Wampanoag Trail driving in, and I was trying to call into the station because I was letting our producer Brett know that I was running a little bit late. And to make sure he put a couple of commercials on before we got here. And just that little effort to punch the keys in and everything. All of a sudden, I see the lights in the back of behind my car. Well, guess what? I'm going to be a little bit later now because there's a local East Providence police officer.
Got to go hands-free. That's
pulling
what Bluetooth
me over.
Is for.
Yep, he's pulling me over. And he came over and he recognized me. He goes, oh, hi. Are you Don Soa? I said, yeah. He said, I said, well, I was trying to call into my producer because I'm running late. He says, well, all right, I'm not going to hold you up anymore. He says, but I could see you were weaving in and out a little bit. I assume you weren't drinking. I said, no, I'm just drinking in life, sir, living the life, drinking it all in. I said, no, I was literally trying to call. And I didn't realize that little bit of distraction is enough to have you weaving in and out of the lanes. And the officer was right. And you don't realize you're creating a danger for the people around you. And that's not a good thing.
But if you do have a question, you're welcome to call in. Locally here, it's 437-5000.
Well, pull over. Pull over and call Brett. He's here. He's taking calls, so plug it into the screen. If you're not in the immediate area, 888-345-0790. The stock market closed lower today, a couple of days in a row now, as investors were starting to mull over the prospects of higher monetary policy. As ridiculous as this is, we've been talking about interest rates going up. We've pretty much predicted.
So it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody.
Well, we told them they're going to do it at least twice this year, probably over an 85% chance that they would do it here in the month of March, the first meeting on the 15th. I said, why do they get worked up about it? If in fact the Fed raises the interest rates, that means that they are confident that the economy standing alone based on its own merits is strong enough to offset any higher cost of money, which is what happens when you raise interest rates. The cost of money goes up slightly. But they want to do that. They've been trying to get the Fed fund rate up to a reasonable level because it's been it was at zero for seemingly endless amount of time. And then they added a quarter of a point one December, then the following December another quarter of a point. Well, here we are at a half a point, and they're suggesting, well, you know, maybe 1% is okay. It's obviously, you know, even when we get up to 1% at the end of the year on the Fed fund rate, it's still going to be historically low. It's historically cheap. It means that the Federal Reserve is still, from a stimulus perspective, still extremely accommodating. Mm-hmm. So, again, why on earth they should use that as the excuse for why the markets are volatile, it's hard to say. I think probably the bigger issue, rightly or wrongly, that gets people worked up or concerned is probably legislation coming out of Washington, D.C., and more of the talk. We had House Republicans today offering legislation to repeal and replace, you know, the Affordable Care Act, best known as Obamacare. This is typical of a market that is sort of reassessing maybe why the stock market went into orbit in the first place since November. The fundamentals do support a relatively stable market right now. It's not like it's overly expensive, overly overbought. But in fact, a lot of the low-hanging fruit's already been picked. You're seeing the market not do much of anything at this stage of the game because they figure, hey, we've run up a sizable amount so far since November. We're looking at, in some cases, as much as 6 and 7%, depending upon what area of the market you're in. That's an awful lot to be seen in a matter of a few months. Does the market have to have a major correction in this environment? No, it does not. Do I think that there's a reasonable chance that there could be a pullback sometime in maybe the third quarter? Maybe the August, September, October time frame? Yeah, well, that's a time frame where there's a very thin trading volume taking place to begin with.
And we commonly see a pullback if there's an environment to have
one. If there's going to be one, that's when it will typically happen. And then what happens is a lot of times the market will rebalance and reset in the last quarter of the year, which would be that November, December time frame.
Remember, a pullback doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to suddenly be negative for the year. It's just meant to be, as you often will explain it, letting a little bit of the air out of the balloon, right?
Yeah.
And then allowing room to reinflate, I guess.
And for those of you who were overly conservative in the market and might not have had much in the stock market over the last few months,
could create an opportunity.
It could be your chance to actually go in and take another shot at making some money in the market. In other words, the prices come down. If the market drops 5 or 6%, the market's on sale for you. It's a reset, and it gives you an opportunity to get in for the next phase of the market. Now, the market is predictive as an indicator. It's not guaranteed, but it's predicting what we think may be happening going forward. Why? Because investors who believe something good might happen might want to get into the market to take advantage of that, but they want to get in before it actually happens. Buy low, sell high. So you're going to get in before the market starts to move up dramatically and then hopefully ride up most of the gain. And then when you get up to some reasonable level, some level that you think, okay, there's not a lot of evidence to suggest why it should go higher than this, well, maybe that's when you do the really hard thing. The hardest part of the decision-making process is not getting into the market.
Oh, it's when to get out.
It's when to get out. It's having the courage to say, okay, geez, I just made 6 or 7% in a matter of 3 or 4 months. Maybe I should, unload part of it. Maybe take some of the profit off the table if that's the way to go.
Yeah, when we say getting out, it doesn't mean getting out of the market altogether. It just means maybe this is an opportunity to rebalance or remove part of a position.
Well, anyway, the Dow was down about 29 points today. Chevron contributed the most to that decline. The S&P 500 was down about 0.29%. Energy leading decliners there as well. The two indices that posted their first, really, their first two-day losing streak since the beginning of this year, the NASDAQ was down also about 0.26%. Now, we may actually be on the cusp of, you know, sometimes whether they call it a pullback, sometimes they refer to it as a consolidation based on some of the rather impressive gains that we've seen posted since the election, according to Peter Buchvar. Peter's with the Lindsay Group. He's an analyst with those folks. He also pointed out that the number of New York Stock Exchange issues that closed at a 52-week low outnumbered those that closed at a 52-week high. Well, I don't know how strong an indicator that is one way or another, but it gives you some sense of some of the data that the analysts and the commentators are looking at to determine what direction the markets are going. But in fact, the GOP healthcare proposal includes killing the requirements that most Americans must have health insurance or pay some sort of a fine, among other changes. So that was a part of the big discussion going on today with the Republican leadership trying to explain some of the elements, some of the details of what will be a lengthy replacement plan for the Affordable Care Act when it actually does occur. Hey, folks, you're listening to Get Back to Basics Tuesday here on the Money Talk program with Donna Sowa Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa, and we'll be right back, so please stick around. And we are back with the Money Talk program. It's Get Back to Basics Tuesday with Donna Allard and myself. Donna, on a previous show, we were talking about some actually, I don't know if I'd say disturbing, that's probably an overkill, but statistics that I suppose at some level surprised me a little bit. And it relates to a generation of people, especially now the baby boomers, who are already either in retirement at the lead edge or slowly moving into retirement. It's like I said, this is almost 80 million people that fit into this particular category. And it will have, overall, a very large impact on the way in which we do things in government, the way in which programs such as Social Security retirement and other entitlement programs, the way they operate, the way in which they may need to be changed and reformed in the future. But more importantly, it's the discussion coming out of a number of major financial entities, including the AARP and Fidelity and a number of big financial houses, as well as academia. There are colleges, including Boston College, that have major programs that deal with the study of retirement and the study of, because there's a psychology to it, as well as a number of other things. And they've done some very large surveys in which they've surveyed thousands of people. Fidelity did one just recently that I was looking at. And they were asking questions to find out what is the average or reasonable expectation that people have in a number of specific categories, the specific questions that they would ask related to what will be, obviously, for most of these people that are queried, they are, you know, questions about what they think retirement should look like, could look like, may look like. What kind of expectations do they have?
Like expectations for lifestyle.
Yeah, what do they have? Maybe you could ask. They got away from asking that very broad question, or are you comfortable with your position in terms of a potential retirement, and started.
Well, the majority of people surveyed in any of these surveys, the older they are or they are closer to retirement, typically you find that they are more realistic about the fact that they are not as prepared for retirement as they should be or would like to be.
Well, so they started out with some questions that didn't kind of give away what the direction they're going in. And among them would be, as you are, with 10 years or 15 years to go to retirement, potentially this group or less maybe, what, as an investor in the stock market, for example, using various types of stock funds, ETFs or mutual funds, what rate of return do you believe, on average, the stock market will probably return, or at least the stock portion of your portfolio? What expectation do you have for what rate of return you should enjoy between now and your normal retirement?
So this is someone who has less than 10 years to retirement to go. So let's frame that, because someone who has less than 10 years to retirement should not be all in stocks.
But they did ask the question that way, though. They said, if you look at the stock portion portfolio.
This is a very big setup for this question.
Yeah,
I'm
reading it from an article.
Yeah.
So when you're reading an article, you know, they're going to try to give you the details because what happens ultimately as you try to answer the question is you start asking other questions.
Sure. So if they're looking at stock returns, there is, old adages, rules of thumb. When people look at historical stock market returns and look back and say, well, and I know there are some very famous radio people who have touted the 10% or 12 up to 12% as, average historical stock market returns. That is not a realistic number. But I know that numbers in the between 8 to 10% are very common for people to associate with, long-term stock market averages.
Well, the same group, probably not the same people.
Am I answering?
Yeah. The same sponsor back in 1985 asked the same question.
Well, you're going to get a very different
answer. Of people. They said, looking back historically to 1927, when we first started gathering data, the average would have been between 9 and 12%.
Yeah, and that average has continued, really did continue, I would say, right up until, even kind of through the Great Recession, right? Even once you got through the Great Recession and we saw fantastic returns following over the last 7 years or so, that would still support a long-term average. But we have to remember that long-term averages, one, don't necessarily project forward, and two, just because it's a long-term average, that doesn't mean it's your average going forward, because sequence of returns has a huge effect on your actual performance.
Well, what they did with it was they said, well, now, in the period that we're in today, with whatever experience you might have had as an investor since 1995, what rate of return would you feel was appropriate to look out over the next, say, 10 or 15 years? As you're planning for your retirement, what rate of return would you normally expect on the equity side or the stock side of your portfolio?
And did they give that typical 8 to 10%?
It was 8 or 9. It was between 8 and 9 was the average. It came out to 8 or 9. And that was...
So now, to most people, that's not going to sound outrageous, right? That doesn't sound outrageous as a long-term average. But if I even look at our the financial planning software we use, we don't use historical averages when we're looking at market returns. We'll use forward-looking projections. And the most aggressive portfolio still, if we're using forward-looking projections, will only produce an average of about 7% return. So that shows you how it's been tempered.
Well, they built on that set of questions with, you know, looking at a more broader, you had even alluded to it, more diverse portfolio. And they said that, well, we're in an environment where if you could get 9 to 12% on stocks before, and you were looking at an average of 7 to 8% in the bond market, for the bond portion of your portfolio, which would be a combination, of course,
which
of,
we are not.
A combination of dividends and capital appreciation give you a total return in that range. They said, well, looking forward from where we are now, they said if that were the case, and let's just say for sake of a fairly moderate to conservative portfolio that's 50-50. So they say, okay, if you get 9% on your stocks, the 50% weighting on that will give you 4.5% contribution. And if you're going to get 7% on your bonds, you know, that would give you another 3.5. So 4.5 and 3.5 would give you 7 to 8% is the weighted return on what they consider to be a fairly risk-adjusted portfolio. 50-50 would be considered fairly risk-adjusted. The risk profile of bonds having a much lesser correlation to the stock market. So how you blend it that way. But what we're the premise overall on the article said that at the same time, using those same numbers, if you were able to get a 7% return on your money during your retirement years or approaching retirement, I said, once you actually got to retirement, then you could turn around and you could pull out somewhere in the range of about 4.5 to 5% annually to live on and
account for inflation,
allowing for a lot of different things like that. And those are numbers. I think that what surprised the author of the article was that so many people, when you're dealing with thousands of people being surveyed, that so many of them had not really been paying attention to a lot of the debate, I guess, and the rhetoric that has followed really since maybe the beginning of 2000 to where we are now. In the 21st century, those numbers, and we're already 17 years into the 21st century, those numbers have already changed rather dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, I started in industry in 2006, so I'm over here for 11 years, and even throughout that time, my expectations were always lower than that. They were always lower than that.
Well, we were looking at a survey only a year and a half ago, went down to New York for a conference, and the largest money manager in the world is a company called BlackRock. And they do an extraordinary amount of research. For those of you who are not familiar with them, they're among the leading owners and operators of what you'd call exchange-traded funds as well, in addition to a very large family of actively managed mutual funds as well under the BlackRock name, and a number of private accounts where you have to have hundreds of millions of dollars to even work with them. So they're big, big money managers, large institutional money managers. And their research arm has suggested that if you look at a number of factors, including the growth rate, potential growth rate of the U.S. economy, which would give you some indication of what's reasonable for earnings growth at the corporate level, and a few other factors, including inflation, and they've suggested that really the more realistic level of return for at least the next, we're not willing to go out more than 5 years because they figure things change. But they said if you look out over the next 5 years, you should be telling your clients that the stock portion of their portfolio, if done properly, should produce 6% return, not 8 or 9.
And that's going to be 6% total return, right?
on the stock side,
including your growth and dividends, right?
And what that would mean if you're investing in a blue chip portfolio, then 2% of it is the dividend. The S&P 500's average dividend is 2%, and then 4% from the share price appreciation.
Yeah, so consider that total return. And I think that is what most people do think of initially when they think of the stock portion of their portfolio. They're looking at the S&P 500.
Now, likewise on bonds. Now, bonds are going to be part of a properly allocated and diversified portfolio. They are likewise not going to produce 7% total return. Much more likely the numbers they used was somewhere in the 4% range, which meant about 3 of it might be selectively on the dividend side. And another 1% would be the potential for appreciation in the share price of the fund through appreciation of the bonds. But bonds are not likely to appreciate in an environment typically where interest rates are rising.
No, so if we're looking at, you know, a diversified portfolio that really, or moderate portfolio that's diversified, it really brings down that average, your expectations for average return over time for someone who is near or at the beginning of their retirement.
Now, what does all this mean? Well, when we come back from this halftime break here on the Money Talk program, Donna and I are going to discuss how this actually affects you in retirement. This is talking about, average returns between now and the time you retire.
Now I've got to use my money.
How does it affect the strategy that we have to employ once you actually retire and start needing monthly income? I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard, and this is Get Back to Basics Tuesday on the Money Talk program. We'll be back with more on AM 790, your home of talking business. Okay, if you wonder what people do when they're actually not on the air between segments, we're looking online on the screen here. If you love dogs and you love babies, it's called Dogs Love Babies. Just Google that. You're going to get a bunch of pictures. We'll have you doing nothing but laughing out loud for the entire time.
Nothing makes you feel good like a sweet little chubby new baby and a lovey-dovey little dog.
Well, isn't that why serious actors will say, I don't ever want to have to act in a scene with dogs or babies? Because they will always show you up. You can't possibly compete with them for people's attention when it comes right down to it. Now, before we went to break, we were talking about the issue of expectations that people should reasonably have. And perhaps expectations, starting the survey we were looking at, expectations that are not realistic. I mean, when these people are looking at potentially 7 to 9 or 8 or 9% return on their stocks and 6 or 7% on their bonds, if they genuinely think that that's what they can get, then no matter what they do with their portfolios, Donna, they may get lucky enough and have 1 year that's an aberration out of any 5 or 10 years in which they do double, either a high single digit or double digit returns.
Well, sure. I mean, in conversations with clients looking at last year's performance, don't we say that it was a great year, but I wouldn't expect that same return going forward for the next couple of years.
Well, I tell people, like, look, first of all, don't ever suggest or try to plan for what's going to happen next year, or say, here we are 2017. Don't try to guess what 2017 will look like, because number one, we started off strong, which was an aberration. It's typical not to be up 6 or 7% at the end, in the middle of March. And then it can, I think if you want a metaphor for it, look at a pendulum. If a pendulum swings way too much to the right,
it's got to go back to equilibrium.
The momentum on it's going to bring it back far more to the left than it should be, left versus right. So now at some point, again, it balances out. But in the end, there's usually typically an overreaction. I think when you have a really, really bad year in the stock market, we warn people, if you're able to tolerate the emotions of looking at how much the value of the account dropped in that brief period, understand that in almost every case we've ever seen historically, the year and a half that follows that really bad year is almost it's like a mirror version of the bad year.
A mirror reverse.
To the upside.
And I mean, if you look at any chart of market returns for a long time period, it's very evident in the lines.
Talking to a number of people who saw losses major declines in the year 2008. Now, I realized there were elements of the market that dropped 44%. But, I mean, if I looked through many meetings that I sat in on and sat and put through with people, we were looking at people who were down, say, for between 15 and 22%. But that wasn't really the story that they needed to be aware of. The story they need to be aware of when you look back historically, that really by the summer of 2009, the following year, many of them had already recovered. I mean, imagine that, going 7 or 8 months into the following year, after a year where you lost 15% of your money, and yet you're already back to that level within 7 or 8 months.
Yeah, you need to have the fortitude to ride through it and not make those emotional-based decisions. People really thought the market was going to go to zero. Yeah. People really thought that. So you got to fight that and to enjoy the upside.
Yeah, and so you've got to be really careful about understanding how markets have worked in the past, understanding that this is one of the reasons that investors are not as successful as investments in the market. The investments can do very well, but it's the emotional behavior and reaction of the investor that determines whether you participated in it or not. So there's so much that's a part of that. But ask yourself, do you think if you sat there and watched your account go down 15 or 20%, do you think you'd have the discipline and the understanding to leave that alone as you went into a new year? And say, okay, I'm going to stay in here so that I can increase my chance of recovering what I gave up in terms of market volatility. Well, if you can get past using the term I lost money instead of the value of my account has declined.
And those are two different things, right?
Because that means that you recognize that the market is behaving cyclically. It's in a cycle. In that it will, as part of that cycle, at some point come back. Now, the question is, will you be in it as it recovers? Or will you be the guy that jumped out because you just couldn't handle it anymore and, of course, watch it go up and start asking an even more difficult question? At what point do I get back in? At what point is this recovery real?
I'll tell you when. It will be too late when you do.
If not too late, you've given up an awful lot of that opportunity to recover as part of that mix. But as part of all of this psychology, you know, we're looking into getting you to a point financially as an investor during your early years when you're Donna's age in her 30s, where you should be a growth-oriented investor. You should be, mm-hmm. Your portfolio should be dominated by equity or growth-oriented investments. It doesn't mean you have entirely growth, but heavily weighted, and understand that you have the time to tolerate some of the cycles that I was just talking about, up and down. But you are a growth-oriented investor. You get closer to retirement and you become what we call a growth and income investor. Meaning that growth is the principal goal in your portfolio, but income, or shall I say the other side of the market cycle, which is fixed income and alternative investments that don't correlate directly to the stock market, that's the other side of the portfolio. We'll call it the income side because many of them are dividend-paying assets like REITs or bonds of different types and things of that sort. So you are a principal growth investor with income as a secondary goal. But you, in that case, you might be 65, even 70% growth and 30 to 35% in the fixed income or alternative side. Now, the closer and closer you get to the point where you're going to actually retire, and more importantly, now have to change. The issue of how you allocate your money is not because you're suddenly old.
No, it actually doesn't have to do with your age. It has to do with what your needs are and the time in which you're going to need to access this money for income. So if you're going to need to take this money for income in 2 years, it doesn't matter whether you're 55 or 65. What matters is when you're going to need to access the money.
Now, interestingly, you should, having heard if you understand what we just said, it wouldn't shock you to realize that there are some people who actually get to retirement. They leave their workplace. In other words, they separate from service, from work. But maybe they have other alternative sources of income that may be coming into them. They may have savings in the bank. They may have some rental properties that create rental income for them. They may even be among those rare people nowadays who have a pension that they will now be eligible for to receive a monthly check from their company or from a municipality. We have some people who had put a number of years into military service, and when they got to 65, they were eligible to receive a pension from there. Now, the point that I'm really making here is that if you're eligible for Social Security and from a small pension and maybe from other alternative sources of income, but you've also saved $200,000 or $300,000 in an IRA or a 401k plan, I said you may be a different mentality as an investor because you say, I don't need any income now at age 65 or 66 from my investment plan. So this was a growth and income portfolio, 65, 35, say, as I was getting closer to my age 65. But now that I got here, I've run the numbers, and I actually don't need to draw any monthly income from my plan to supplement my other sources of income, at least not for several years, I think.
So
is that different then in terms of how
that's
aggressive they could be?
In fact, I have a client that I work with who really doesn't need the money that's in his IRA. So we have it in a growth portfolio because the all of his income needs are currently covered by Social Security and his pension.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So your
that happens a lot. We see in Rhode Island, for example, we've seen that an awful lot with people who are teachers. We had a couple who were both teachers who were in their 70s, and their combined municipal pensions are substantial. They don't need any more money. They actually said they're saving money every month from their check, but they both contributed to 403B plans through their school system. So they have substantial savings portfolios, and they get angry because the government requires them to take money out at age 70 and a half.
What a nice position to be in.
Nice to be in. Yeah. Let's go out to Jim out in Pawtucket. Jim, welcome to the Money Talk program. How you doing?
Hi, Don and Donna. Yeah, so me and my wife, I'll be hopefully 64. My wife will be 60 when we retire, and we have, you know, a bit of money for a pension. We still have kids just going into college, but we should have enough money for that. And anyway, the long and short of it, do you think 65,000 is reasonable sitting in just CDs and money markets, you know, I mean, we use, you know, sometimes we take out 10 or 20,000 here and there, but do you think,
Jim, how much do you think you spend typically in an average year, just supporting your lifestyle?
Oh, geez.
That's always the question.
Oh, he didn't know that I was going to ask him that, right?
Yeah, I don't really know.
Well, because what I'm asking is, this is an emergency or a liquid fund that you have, like a nest egg fund. Now, this is separate from your retirement assets, right? Okay. I like the idea, as you will get closer to retirement, that you have the equivalent of 6 months of expenses, just liquid, in a fund like the one you're talking about.
We have way more than that. But
well, what I'm saying is, if you look at your expenses and you say, look, I spend $3,000-$4,000 a month on things that, you know, support my lifestyle, or some of it's discretionary, some of it's fixed expenses, whatever. Well, if that's true, then you would need $24,000 in a liquid portfolio and an emergency fund to accommodate that six-month target.
And, you know, I've got to tell you, what you're talking about is a conversation that I've actually had twice this week, because people are sitting on a large amount of cash and starting to just say, wait a minute, I'm looking at what the market has done over the past 6 months or rolling 12 months versus the 1% that I'm getting on my money market, and it just starts to feel really bad, right? You feel like you're missing out.
My rule of thumb, Jim, like what Donna's suggesting, my rule of thumb is that if you have 6 months of expenses in a liquid fund, that's a good place to be psychologically. But beyond that, if you've suggested you have more than that. So there is an amount of money, and I'm saying it this way because it's unique to each person that asks the question. If there's a certain amount of money, when you know what even a fairly moderate, if you know that a moderate to conservative portfolio could produce 3 or 4% return, that's moderate to conservative. So you're not taking a lot of risk there.
Yeah.
But you've got so much money sitting at 0.5% to 1% in CDs or money markets. How much money can you have in that bank account at those low levels before you start to feel foolish if you think you could get 3 or 4 in an alternatively conservative to moderate account? So that's a personal decision. You say, if I keep more than 35,000 or 40,000 in a liquid portfolio, but by the way, which is accessible and it's also FDIC insured. So there's a psychology to it, okay?
Right.
But if you get to that point and say, you know, if I've got 75,000 and, you know, any amount more than 40 in something that pays me nothing, do I feel a little foolish at that, knowing that there's better other alternatives that are not extremely risky? If that's the case, well, then that's the point where you start moving. And by the way, you don't have to do it all at once. I'd say, you know, do 10,000 at a time.
Well, we have it in a most of our retirement money and our Roth IRA and like a, you know, one of those like Fidelity 2020. So I mean, like a T. Rowe Price. So it's like 60% in stocks,
yeah,
and
40%
in bonds. So I feel like, and then we have some other like little, you know, some bit of stocks like in an account. So I don't know. I just felt like that. That's my conservative money. So you think it's still.
But you know something, Jim. Again, if you don't feel foolish holding on to $75,000 in a bank account, then that's the right number. If you don't feel foolish, it's the right number.
Yeah, that's kind of my.
And if the rest of your money can produce 4 to 6%, which I'm familiar with the plan you have, if you can produce 4 to 6% there, then if that's the bulk of your money, then you're not being foolish.
Yeah, that's kind of my attitude. So.
And isn't it cool that that money's available for anything?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be an emergency. Maybe it's an opportunity. I like that. Take a trip.
Right, right.
And by the way, you've got young kids. You said it yourself, in college-age students. The emergencies.
There's going to be plenty of
emergencies that we haven't even thought of could come up, and I don't want to wish you ill. So, hey, good luck and Happy New Year to you, James.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Money Talk program. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back with more Money Talk. Get Back to Basics Tuesday. And we're back with the Money Talk program, talking about retirement, and quite frankly, to try to encourage you to be realistic in your expectations of what your money can grow to prior to retirement. And this is especially important, folks, if you know, because you don't have a pension. Most people don't anymore. A pension being a plan that will pay you a monthly income for the rest of your life. The Social Security may be the closest thing you have to that. And again, with all the potential for reforms in the future, you don't know what you could expect from Social Security going forward. So that said, then your defined contribution plan, which is money that may come out of your paycheck, go directly into a plan sponsored by work, or something you had to do on your own because you were a disciplined saver. If you're expecting to get a much higher rate of return, and remember, these are the numbers that you plug into your retirement analysis when you're going on that calculator online. If you're plugging in an expectation of 8 or 9% return for your stocks and even averaging in your bonds, if you're thinking 7, 7.5% return, that number may set you up for disappointment because if you get down to normal retirement at those levels, they're not necessarily realistic, and you may end up with a lot less money than you thought you'd get at your retirement target age.
Yeah, when we do our planning, if we're looking at a balanced portfolio, we're looking for a forward-looking average return of between 5 and 6% as a more realistic number, at least with the information that we have now.
Now, remember, too, using the rule of 72, now we've talked about that here on the show, a 6% return on your money on average will get you, will double your money in about 12 years. Now,
if that's with perfect math, though.
And that's also, that assumes you're not adding new money. If you're adding new money as you go along the way, dollar cost averaging, then you have an opportunity to grow your portfolio even more. But keep this in mind, once you get to retirement, then the other side of that is how much can you draw out of the plan? Let's say you're going to retire at 65. You know, Donna's generation, the baby, not so much the baby boomers, but we're still living a lot longer than we ever did before. But we're trying to warn the millennials, as those that are in their 30s and early 40s right now, that they're going to likely live well into their 90s as a group, as a generation.
You know, someone today, a man today who reaches 65 is expected to live something to be like 84.4 or something like that. And a woman's expected to live to be 86. Over 86 and a half. So that's for today's 65-year-old. It's
and you know, the actuaries are changing. The actuaries are changing this as we go. So don't be shocked if I'd say 60.
We're planning into 90s. Into your 90s.
We keep talking about 30 years. If you're using what they call the 4% rule, which means whatever amount of money you have invested, assume that you can make probably 5.5 or 6% total return. Draw out 4 of it. Well, if you're doing that, under the old models, there was an expectation
that
you had a 90% plus chance of having that money last 30 years or longer. If you, in fact, are being realistic now, some people have suggested you should probably be more conservative than that and assume a 3 to 3.5% withdrawal rate. But we've tried to look to see, well, what are the scenarios that you could do that will allow you to actually draw out more, maybe that 4 or 4.5%, and not worry about whether you're going to run out of money. And the answer was, and this is for what they call an active retirement management program. Now, this is something that you maybe can do on your own if you are the right personality for it, if you're a bit of an analytical and you enjoy doing it. That's one side of it. But it's, of course, the selfish argument that we make as professionals to say, well, that's why we have jobs. That's why we have a profession that's, you know, the retirement planning investment advisory plan.
Yeah, you need to be regularly rebalancing as a big part of it.
So that means that, you know, whatever amount you allow, don't plan out for the next 10 years. Yes, look out that way. Try to project a little bit. But maybe look out just at the next 12 months in terms of your income needs and go in and draw out the amount you think is appropriate. Let's say it's 4 or 4.5. Now, if you get to the end of the year and you've actually outperformed your target of 6% for the portfolio, well, that you can breathe easier. I mean, it buys you some extra time. And what it does is a really good year that you might have affords you the ability to have a bad year. But if you have a bad year, maybe the following year you adjust a little bit by reducing some of your expenses, reducing some of what you draw out of the plan, allow the plan maybe a year or two to recover. If you do that, then you are extending the overall life of your retirement plan.
I just have to remember, you're withdrawing a percentage of the assets, not a fixed number.
By the way, if you're already working with a certified financial planner, financial advisor, talk to them about this. Find out their attitude about it and what you might need to be doing. Get your head in the right place before you even get there. Hey, I'm Don Sowa with Donna Sowa Allard. This has been Get Back to Basics, and this is basic and important data related to your financial independence. Have a good night.